Accession number 18199, Real 1. Yeah.
Run Lobby Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
Lambeth, South London.
Lambeth?
Yep.
Which year was this?
1932.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Lambeth?
No, so I was evacuated in 1940 to Cornwall, Tintagel in Cornwall, with the school actually, which was South Lambeth Road Infant School. But I returned to London at the Christmas 1942, and by this time we were living in Kensal Rise. My parents had moved to Kensal Rise. They were blasted out in the home that they were living in Lambeth.
Did you leave before the bombing started?
Yes, before the actual blitz started. But when I came back to London, of course, you still had a few air raids, and I was in London all through the V1 and the V2 attacks.
Can you tell me about your evacuation, how that went?
Very good. I was very, very lucky. It was quite funny the first day, because on the way down, we were told we were going to the seaside, and this was great, you know, no compunctions at all about leaving home. And on the way down, I got a smut in my eye from the engine. We were all sticking our heads out the window. And the eye came up inflamed, and everybody had a gouge at it. The teacher had a gouge at it. And by the time we were put on a bus to go to Tintagel from Camford Station, the eye had got quite inflamed. And they called the doctor, and he put some drops in, and the eye came up even more. And we were put in a big hall. And the local villagers came round and they selected which evacuee they wanted. Well, nobody wanted me before I got the plague or something, because his eye was out here somewhere. And there was one of the helpers had a big dog, and I was making a fuss with this dog, and of course it quite befriended it. And in the end, I was the last child left in that hall, and nobody knew what to do with me, and I wouldn't be separated from this dog. I was only 7. And I said, I want to go and live with this dog, you know. It's the only sort of friend I seem to have in the world. And with that, the helper said, well, we didn't plan to take any evacuees, but yes, well, okay, we will take him. So I went and stayed with these people, and I was quite lucky, really. It was a nice cottage up on the cliffs, and looking back, my evacuee days were very, very good. It was a freedom that you couldn't have in London. You know, to roam about on the cliffs, on the beaches, and it was really nice, and they were quite nice people too. And there was another boy came and stayed with us for a while as well. The only thing, of course, schooling was pretty mucked up, really. And I think basically that's why my parents brought me back to London, because they felt the schooling wasn't adequate there.
In what way was it mucked up?
Well, when we first went there, we had to share with the village school. So we went in the mornings, and they went in the afternoons. Then after a while, we were given a schoolroom of our own in an old hall. But the teachers were mostly quite elderly. Obviously, the younger teachers were away in the forces. And the teachers were quite elderly. And probably the instruction wasn't as good as it should have been. So my parents brought me back to London believing it would be better. But of course, coming back, even though the main bulk of the air raids had finished, you still had interruptions in the lessons through air raids. You weren't going to shelters, particularly when the V1 started up again. You spent quite a bit of the time, school time, in the shelters, you know, just the teachers just reading to you or letting you do your own thing.
Did any bombs fall in the Tintagel area?
No. The only evidence you would have ever known there was a war on, you could see the convoys out in the Bristol Channel. And the German aircraft used to use a hill behind the town or village as a landmark. And they would fly in from the Bristol Channel, using this hill as a landmark, fly directly over, because it's directly in line with Plymouth. So they would drop their bombs on Plymouth and then straight across the channel back to Germany. So you would be able to see the fires even that far away from Plymouth. And then eventually they put a radar station on the cliff top. And basically that was the only sign of war that was there. You saw troops obviously going backs and forwards on exercises, but until the radar station came there, there was no sign of the war on.
How did the evacuee children get on with the locals?
Didn't. To be quite honest, you didn't. The Cornish are very parochial anyway, aren't they? As a race, you know. And we didn't get on with them, no. Yeah. So once the schools separated, we went our way, they went theirs, really.
What was their exact attitude towards you?
Just unfriendly, really. Just unfriendly. And of course, also they being brought up in the country, understood the countryside. Whereas of course, a lot of the London children never been to the country before. And I suppose it's rather like if a Cornish person at that time came to London, he would be completely lost and be like another world to him, really.
Were the people who took you in Cornish?
Whew, now you're asking me. They were West Country, certainly. I think they were from Devon. I think. I'm not really sure. I'm not really sure.
But would the Cornish not speak to you?
Well, some would. I mean, obviously the other boys that we knew, they were with families who, some families were nice, some were not. There were people who were friendly, but I think the children, no, they weren't. They weren't. We didn't sort of mix with the village children at all.
Were there any fights?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there were fights. Yeah.
Did you get into fights?
On occasions, yeah.
Serious ones?
No, I think, you know, at 7 or 8, 9 years old, you don't really get into serious fights, do you? Perhaps some of the older boys did, because some of the boys were obviously 13, 14, you know. And there were a couple of my friends whose parents were killed in the Blitz, and they were actually adopted by the people they were staying with and stayed down there.
Did you feel homesick?
I don't think I did, no. I don't think I did. I might have on occasion, but I think by and large, no, because it was such a nice life, really.
Can you tell me more about Kensal Green Kensal Rise during the second half of the war, please?
Yeah, we had a couple of buzz bombs drop quite near. I remember was a Saturday afternoon, and there had been several alerts that particular afternoon, and my father was away at the time, and I said to my mother, I'm fed up, we're running downstairs and going under the stairs or in the air raid shelter in the garden. I said, the next one that comes, I'm just going to duck under the kitchen table. So she sort of said, all right, you know. And of course the alert went again, overcame this buzz bomb, you could hear it, you know, you know what they sounded like. And the engine cut out and bang, it came down at Kensal Green Station actually, which I suppose as the crow flies is about, it's probably about 1,000 yards, and there was a tremendous crash in our hall, and when my mother opened the kitchen door, we lived on the top flat, there was dust all over the place, but you couldn't see any damage. It was quite strange, you could not see any damage, yet there was dust and brick dust everywhere, and we suddenly realised that the trap door that led up into the loft had been blown out by the blast, had spun up in the air and come down exactly in the square. So you're looking at what had been a nice shiny polished top, you're now looking at a dust covered top. It actually dropped straight back in the square. Amazing.
What was your address at that time?
69 Hanover Road.
69?
Hanover Road. Mm. So again, like the schooling was quite interrupted. You had to play out in the street, you couldn't go to the park. But as things eased up, we used to go up the park and play football and round the allotments, and there was also a searchlight battery in the park. and there was only a little area to play, and if the ball went in the allotments, you know, there would be hell to pay. The allotment holders weren't very happy about giving you your ball back and landed on their prize cucumber. But if it landed in the army camp, they wouldn't be. You had to wait for the sentry to come round, and he would always kick it back. He'd perhaps make out he was going to bayonet the ball or something first, but the sentries would always kick it back. The allotment holders weren't so amenable. And of course, schooling was interrupted quite considerably by the V1s. And I can always recall a V2, but it must have been one of the very first V2s. I think it was about, it was quite a hot day, and the schoolroom I was in was on the first floor. And it was a hot day, and all the windows were open. All of a sudden, there was a tremendous explosion, and you saw this column of smoke shooting up. And it was this, at this time when the government weren't telling you about the V2s. So nobody actually knew what it was. We all thought it was an ammunition train or something had gone up. But it was actually a V2, one of the very first ones, which landed at Chiswick. And that was the start of the first V2 I can remember. And then, of course, the war ended, and we had a big bonfire in the street, big party in the street. My father was, he'd been a regular soldier. He did 21 years in the army. But he was reported back for duty for World War II, but he was not taken back because he had trench foot. And he worked in a factory. He worked as a, sorry, he worked as a, what they called it, fire spotter for a while at Somerset House. But then after the Blitz, my parents moved to Greenford for a while. And he then got a job at Hoover's factory at Park Royal. And what happened, he knew nothing about industrial life at all. And he was given a job on a degreasing tank, which is a chemical, trico. And in the First World War, he'd been gassed. Now what happened was that this trico reactivated the gas after all these years. And he went down, he was quite seriously ill. And he was away for about 2-3 years, I suppose, in a sanatorium. And didn't come back till about the end part of the war before he came home again. I remember going to the station and meeting him. And his health had gone, it was broken, you know.
Was your period in London in the second half of the Second World War an unhappy time for you, a frightening time?
I think you're too young, really, to be frightened. You death is sort of so remote. I was just a little story I could tell you about when I was evacuated. It was quite interesting. I had to get the newspaper on my way home from school, but I was never allowed to read it. I always had to give it in, fold it up. And I brought the newspaper home one evening, and I remember the old chap saying to his wife, he said, "I think it's time that Ronnie was allowed to read the newspaper." And they handed me the newspaper, and it was the news of El Alamein. And across the top of the, I don't know what the newspaper was, probably a local Cornish paper, but across the top of the paper was a map of North Africa. And the headlines were something like, "Eighth Army smashes Germans," or "Axis in full retreat," with arrows that were pointing from El Alamein practically into the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. And I couldn't understand why, from the next day onward, I look at the paper every day to see how much further we'd advanced. And I couldn't understand why the arrow had only moved a fraction, if anything, you know, because the first day it looked like, you know, the Germans were running for their lives, you know. I just couldn't understand the size of North Africa, probably, and how tedious an advance would be, you know. But so I remember that, the first time I ever was allowed to see the paper.
Had he said that because of El Alamein?
I think so, yeah. By that time I was 10 years old, and obviously you knew what was going on and what people would say, but I think at that age you didn't really, you know, never think you were going to lose. Or I mean, you know, one Englishman is worth 10 Germans any day of the week as far as you were concerned, you know. And of course the propaganda you got or any films that you saw were basically directed that way.
Why had he banned you from looking at the newspaper?
Oh, no idea. I suppose he thought I wasn't mature enough or old enough. But see, they were quite strict, in actual fact. They weren't easy on you. They were quite strict. You know, they give you a knocking about if they felt you deserved it. Probably did at times, like any kid. But basically, they were kind people, you know.
Any celebrations you remember at the end of the Second World War?
Oh, yeah, in the road that we had. And if you've ever read, it's rather strange, because if you've ever read V.E. Day, I forget that's written by, or Vera Lynn Remembers, if you've ever read those two books, it will describe the celebrations in Hanover Road. Which was quite, when I read them for the first time, I was quite amazed. I thought, well, we're talking about where I was, and you're actually in it. We made an effigy of Hitler and bombed on a bomb site, and we burnt Hitler. And he burnt too quickly, so everybody was quite annoyed because it didn't last. So we decided to make another dummy. And I remember saying, let's call this one Fatty Goring. And this was actually in the book that somebody suggested he called him Fatty Goring, because it was actually me. And it was most uncanny to read this, you know. That was VE Day. VJ Day, I was in the Scouts, and I was actually at camp in Cornwall, at Par Sands in Cornwall on VJ Day. So all I can remember there was a big bonfire on the beach. That was it, really. And then, of course, then different people was coming home. My cousins and that had been in the war were coming home one by one.
And now, can you tell me about how you came to be in the army yourself, please?
Well, I was National Service. I was called up for National Service. You know, everybody was called up at that time. I wasn't reluctant. I was, and actually, in fact, I fancied joining the army, actually. But my father, having done 21 years, he said, well, you know, there's not much at the end of it if you do, unless you're a tradesman or you're a senior officer or something like that. When after 21 years, he was a farrier, actually, you know, and he was a guard, Scots Guards, he was a machine gun in the First World War, but he actually became a regimental farrier, and he was a professional private, really. He didn't ever want promotion. And he always said that, you know, it's not really, you finish up 21 years with a pension, but you won't have a trade or anything like that behind you that's any use to you in Civvy Street. Well, you're right in some ways and wrong in others, I suppose. So he said to me, well, why don't you do your 2 years, or 18 months it was at that time. Do your 2 years, and then if you like it, well, if you want to stay and that's what you want to do, then that's up to you. But he said, you can try it for 2 years. It's a chance to try out whether you really like to do it or not. So he's right in that respect. Of course, then the Korean War started just before I registered. And by the time I was called up, the 18 months had gone up to 2 years, plus the 3.5 years in the territorials. So when I, what happened, you had to go to for a medical. In my case, it was Bromley Avenue in Acton. And I was given this medical past day one, no problem at all. Just a bit of a problem with my eye, which had been burnt, as I told you about when I was evacuated. And he said, what would you like to do? What would you want to go in? And I said, well, I've been in the Scouts and I was quite good at signalling. I used to know the Morse code and the semaphore, and I knew some of the ship's identification flags and so on. So I said, well, I'd like to go in the signals and be a radio operator. So he said, yeah, no guarantee you get it, but you put it down. And my dad was saying to me, well, you want to go in the Remi? I'm going to train the Remi. Didn't fancy Remi at all. It was too much like work, you know, because I worked as a training machine tool setter at Hoover's at Perivale. And when I came, he said, where are you going? I said, Royal Signals. He said, what are you going there for? I said, well, you know, what I want to do. I don't think he understood that the National Service would put you in to whatever was convenient for them to put you in. I mean, if they wanted infantrymen, they shoved everybody in the infantry, you know. a lot of my friends who'd been called up around about the same time as me had been put into anything but what they wanted to go into. So I was lucky in that respect. I got what I wanted. I went to Catterick Camp, which was the Signals training area at that time. And the worst 4 weeks of my life.
Right.
Basic training.
Why is that?
Well, I don't think I've ever been so, humiliated. And it just was not what I thought at all. I thought, well, you know it's going to be a bit harsh. You knew that from other people who've been in, but I don't think I was really prepared for it, just how much it was, really. Basic training. 4 weeks of really being messed about from minute, morning, noon and night, you know, chased everywhere, bullied, shouted at, all bawled at. The only good thing, I suppose, is everybody was in the same boat. It wasn't just me. And I suppose, basically, the system worked, because 4 weeks later, you were, resembling soldiers.
Can you be specific about what they did?
Well, it was just this continually, nothing you ever did was right. It didn't matter what it was. Even if it was right, it was wrong. And nobody escaped. Somebody could do something perfectly, but they would find something wrong with it, just to stop his cockiness, I suppose. But that's how the system works in the end.
So the idea was to knock the cockiness out of you?
I think so. It was to, yeah. Because I remember we had about 40 men in the troop. There was an officer you hardly ever saw. And the sergeant, the two corporals, Lance Corporals and a full corporal, and they would be walking amongst the ranks, shouting at you, one after the other, and you just had to stand there and take it. You couldn't do anything about it, really. The only good thing about it was, at that period, was, I suppose, the first time for a lot of the fellas, not so much for me, because I played football, so I was used to being in a sort of team environment, if you like, with other guys where you're being told what they want you to do and all that sort of thing. But I think for a lot of them it hadn't been. And you, what should we say, bonded together. Everybody would say, well, I'll help you out if you're in trouble. I'll do this for you if you can't manage it. And I think it was that spirit of togetherness and comradeship, really. It was a very good thing about it. You never got it anywhere else. I think that was the only time you really got it to that degree, that everyone would say, well, you're not going to get in trouble if I can do anything about it, But, boy, I was so relieved when that was over.
Was it necessary to knock the cockiness out of you?
I think it was, yeah. I think, as I say, the system worked. 'Cause 4 weeks later, you were marching up and down as one man, and It was a funny thing. The very first day I was in, they took you in this barrack room, and it was the expression "standby bed," standby bed. So the bed I stood by was by a window, like this. And after a bit of messing about and so on, they said, "Right, we're going to show you how we want you to make your beds in the morning." And the corporal gave a demonstration. And of course, you one sheet on the bed, and then the others were put up. Well, I used to call it vanilla sandwich, like blanket sheet, blanket, one round the top, so it's all squared up. Showed you how to do that, right? You've got a quarter of an hour to get your beds looking like I've just shown you. So, done it. And I thought, well, that doesn't look bad. And he came in down the barrack room, he's throwing beds on the floor, everyone was being thrown up in the air, and what has it come out here, what do you think of that? And he came to me, and he didn't sort of say anything at all, he just looked down, and he said to me, go to that window. So I went to the window, he says, open it. So I opened it. He said, look out. He says, it's raining. I said, yeah, it always rains at Catterick. So he said, pick up your blankets, take them to that window and throw them out. I said, you can't believe it. I wouldn't believe what I'm hearing. He said, are you stupid as well as deaf? He said, you hear what I said? Pick up those blankets, take them to that window, and throw them out. So, oh, God, he doesn't mean it. You know, and I thought, pick the bags up, caught them in the hand like that. And then, as he said, oh, hold it. He said, okay, put them back. He looked me straight in the eye and he said, if ever looked like that again, he said, I don't care if it's 10 foot of snow outside. Out they go. Understand? And every morning, of course, we all had to go and make them all again, you know, and then again. And then eventually he said, right, that's enough, but I'm feeling easy tonight. I'm going to let you go. He said, go to bed. But he said, in the morning, they better look good. And of course, I dreaded it. I thought, oh my God, they don't look any better at all. They look worse. But he never said anything. And I was never, ever, bollocked to use that word, about my blankets again. Though they sometimes look worse, sometimes look better, you know. And I thought, I wonder why. So when we actually finished our basic training, of course, they were having a laugh with us then and a joke, you know. And I thought, I wonder that if that's his little party piece every time he comes to that window when he makes his initial tour. So when we were left to go to our training regiments, we were filing out and he was standing at the door shaking hands with us and wishing us good luck. Well, good luck, Larry, he says to me, you know. And I said, cool. I said, that first day, I said, were my blankets that bad? Or do you always say that when you come to the window? He said, no, Larby. He says, your blankets were in a fucking awful state. Get out. But I'm always convinced that that was a party piece. He always said that. When he came to that spot in the barrack room, whoever was in that bed got told to chuck his blankets out the window. But then, of course, when we went to base to trade training, things changed considerably. It was a lot easier, a lot better. It wasn't that strictness anymore.
How did you take to the trade training?
Not bad, as I said, I knew Morse code anyway. I didn't know some of the procedure. We didn't do semaphore. So I was really, what should we say, a jump ahead of the others because I already knew the code. So the first few weeks anyway, I was well in advance of everyone. Oh, for a while, of course, some people always take to things quite easily and they picked it up and was better in some cases than I was. But eventually passed out about April, I think, 1951.
When were you called up?
1950. November the 2nd, 1950.
Where did you do the trade training?
Burlong Lines, Catterick, Burlong. As in the battle. All the Catterick camps at that time were named after First World War battles. There's 3rd Training Regiment, Royal Signals.
And after the trade training?
We were then given a choice of where you wanted to go, not that you would get it. And that was if you wanted to go to British Army of the Rhine, you said that. If you wanted a home posting, you asked for it. If you wanted to go abroad somewhere, you said depot. Well, I wanted to go abroad. I was dead keen to go abroad, so I said depot. Not very many.